Welcome to the Lost Together podcast. First, let's meet the host. Matt Wardlaw has been interviewing, writing, and talking about music in print and on the radio for over 20 years. The Lost Together podcast features in-depth discussion and debate with special guest contributors and also conversations with artists, producers, and music industry professionals. New and classic artists join us to share stories and insights regarding their musical process. Let's get started.
Welcome to another edition of the podcast. This week, we're dipping into the interview archives for a chat that I had last year with 90s alternative veteran Matthew Sweet. I've done a couple interviews with Matthew over the past couple years, and when I spoke with him in 2014, he was in the midst of a Kickstarter campaign to help raise funds for his new album. During that interview, we spoke about his plans for that new record, and he touched on some choice moments from his past history, including the Girlfriend album and also the follow-up, Altered Beast. We also spoke about his friendship with J.J. Abrams and the art that he was working on using 3D printing technology. At the time that we talked, the Kickstarter was heading towards completion, and he still had a ways to go as far as raising the necessary funds, so he was understandably a bit nervous. The day after the interview, USA Today mentioned his Kickstarter in a story online, and within 24 hours, his album had successfully funded. It was a fun chat, and I'll put a link to that 2014 interview with Matthew in the show notes for this podcast. That brings us to the interview that you're going to hear today, which was recorded in June of last year, and I had the chance to get up to date with Matthew on the progress that he's made on the new record. We also spoke about the direction of the new material, and I asked him for his thoughts about working on an album with a Kickstarter deadline, where you know there are all these people that pledge for the album waiting on the other end of that deadline, and how that compares to working with a traditional record company deadline. Beyond that, we spoke about some of the things that he's struggled with personally and how he's balanced dealing with those things while still working as a professional musician. And in the closing moments of the interview, he shares the story of how he became involved with Tim Burton's Big Eyes movie. Matthew is a guy that every time you speak with him, there's never a shortage of interesting stories. His new album is one that I'm eagerly anticipating. He just did an interview with Stereo Gum, and it sounds like things are edging closer to completion. He's been recording with his usual bandmates, Rick Mink and Paul Chastain, but in the Stereo Gum interview, he reveals that he's also been working with longtime collaborator Greg Leese and Gary Loris of the Jayhawks. The additional recording sessions currently in progress will find him collaborating with Val McCallum, who some of you might know from Jackson Browne's band. And he also mentions Al Jardine from the Beach Boys and Rod Argent as a couple of potential participants that he's still hoping to get on board. It looks like he's presently hoping to release the new album this year in late summer. We'll be looking forward to that. You can visit Matthew online at MatthewSweet.com, and he's also active on Facebook and on Twitter as well. Thanks for listening to this podcast. You can subscribe to our iTunes feed if you're not already subscribed, and you can visit our website, LostTogetherPod.com, for an archive of all the episodes, show notes, and additional ways to listen. Now let's go to my chat with Matthew. I hope you enjoy it. So the last time we spoke, you were in the midst of running a Kickstarter for the new record, and happily that funded, and you've been working on the record, I think. Where are things at?
Look at my little chart here. I haven't done a synopsis for myself last few days. I've got about 7 songs sung and mostly done. I've got another 8 that are recorded backing tracks, and I'm working on various lyrics and things, or if it's something I demoed, I'm still just working on needing to sing it and add some guitars and things. The thing is, this particular bunch of stuff, the 15 real tracks that I recorded with Rick and Paul in a couple months ago, I'm still going to do, I think, one more batch. It probably won't be this many, but I'm still writing, so I think it's going to turn out great, because how can I not have at least half of the songs from this 15, if not more like 10 of them? And then if I do another 10, it's just going to up the quality of what I end up kind of concentrating to be the record itself. And I'm just going to have more demos and bonus tracks, which I'm sure everybody will be happy to get. So I'm a little slow. I guess right now a couple months late, but I'm trying to get the record. The latest goal is to get done by the end of August.
Cool.
My only time I'm touring is really this sort of 9 or 10 days in July when we're coming there. So I'm working a lot on it right now, but I just, you know what I mean? It's just this thing where, like, I can't rush it because I promised it will be really good.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
So what does really good mean? You know, if I rushed it, it might be just as good, but I'm really trying, you know, the way I've always done it, I think at the best is when I have a lot of material and I cull it down to the things that really seem to be working.
Does this feel different than, like, say, the days of old when you might have had a record company deadline attached? Is there more pressure with this deadline? Is it different?
It's different. The thing with record companies is there's much worse pressure that they just wished you would be more successful or whatever. You know what I mean? There's much more of that at record companies where it's like they just wanted to figure out what to tell you to do to be different so you'd be more successful. That thing is gone, which is great, because that's a different kind of pressure where you feel like you could never live up to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The pressure I feel from the Kickstarter is more my pressure on myself to do a really good job, because it's actually this giant group of fans that are, like, sort of funding it, you know? So that's the fun part of it, but I guess it's also on the flip side now. And, you know, I think my story is fairly typical for Kickstarter. I would guess that most people don't make their hopeful deadlines. If I feel any pressure, it's just that I want to deliver it as soon as I can. But on the other hand, I really want it to be strong, undeniably strong. And that makes me go, just keep your nose to the grindstone and, you know, don't get wigged out and keep recording and do it how you have to do it, you know? And I have written to everybody on Kickstarter sort of saying that. Like, I really just can't start on all the other perks until the main thing gets done, you know?
For sure, yeah. And I saw that message, so I kind of knew where you were at with things. It's got to be interesting for you, because I'm assuming that you probably, you know, went into, like, you know, recording with the 15 songs that you had feeling like you were probably in a pretty good place to have the material that you needed to do the record. And I would guess that, like, once you get into the recording, is that kind of where sometimes you'll get the feeling that, like, maybe I'm still missing something, even though you thought you were good going in?
I think it's more likely to be the opposite way. Like, the unknown when I'm recording is, like, sometimes I can't tell what's going to turn out and be really good, you know? So that's one reason why I'm loath to throw things out if there's kind of anything interesting to me going on in them, because sometimes they become something that I just totally didn't expect and would never have realized. And so that's why I want to see them through, kind of, even when they're things I might consider a little more stillborn.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. I never think of them in terms like, I'll work on that hard and make it better, because I sort of feel like they're just intrinsically what they are when I write them.
Yeah.
But I think that I can just get them all to their logical end and go, hey, I do like that one, you know. But I think I do have some sense about it, and I thought, I've done these 15, but I know there's another special batch I'm still going to record. I can just feel that I'll need that. I think this first batch, I've leaned more toward some less incredibly moody or morose kind of music, and more trying to get into having fun playing guitar and recording and having some attitudes about things. And although it seems like those would be easier things to do, I will tend to do less of them usually if I don't do more songs. So this time I've kind of weighted more heavily toward extroverted songs, I guess we call them, in advance, knowing that I'll get good ones if I do enough, you know?
Yeah.
And I think I've saved a little bit of moody specialness for my last batch of songs because I'll know more what I need, and that might help me kind of not have to do too many more, you know?
Interesting. Yeah, I was kind of wondering what would push you away from, you know, the moody, morose stuff in the other direction, but I think you explained that pretty well.
Nah, I'm saying that, and then it's probably plenty that way if
yeah.
someone heard it. You know? There's the conflict in it and stuff, but, you know, there are songs that are, like, Sick of Myself where it's something people can share in more easily because it's a thing that, you know, is upbeat, and it's only the lyrics that kind of subvert kind of that feeling, you know?
For sure.
And I love that, you know, when it can be both things. It's just when you make, you know, kind of bitchin' rock riffs, it's just not that kind of song usually, you know?
Yep. Yeah, for sure.
Like, I always loved, you know, like how the Beatles would have, you know, a wide variety of types of things, and I do want to have that, but I also don't want it to be so eclectic. I want it, and I feel because I've moved, and I'm living in Nebraska, and I have a new studio environment, I feel really grounded, kind of, and it's good for that kind of music, just good, solid, kind of, simple sort of rock music, and I've kind of, in the first round, concentrated more on that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I mean, obviously Omaha, I mean, one difference is the guys have to come to you, but I wondered what sort of things environmentally that might have contributed to the music as a result of the change in your daily environment, so.
Well, you know, it makes me think about my childhood more, not in a way that I want to write songs about my childhood any more than I ever have, but
yeah.
more just a feeling of what it was like when I grew up here and my view of the world. And nature-wise, I really feel it. The changing of the seasons and those things, it's just really different from what I've had. For so many years, I've toured through seasons and stuff, but to be in a place where I really watch that cycle, it's just kind of amazing when it becomes spring and then when everything dies and it's winter, that's really winter. It does give me some sense of just how I felt. And how it's just kind of these wide open spaces and sky. You know, when I first left Nebraska, people would ask me, like, how do you think it influenced you? And I would just say, you know, just this really wide open sky just gave me a feeling of just that things could be anything. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I had very little restriction to how I might imagine stuff. But it never really felt like a good answer to it. But now I'm back here, and that feeling's immediately what I want to say, like, sort of, even though it's hard to explain.
Sure.
So I do, you know, and there's, of course, the family aspect, where I've seen my family and various family members more in the last 18 months than I did in the 20 years before. And, you know, I was got to be here when my mother passed away last year, which was, you know, just a miracle that
yeah.
I was able to be on site, because it just would have been very difficult, I think, had I not lived here.
Yeah.
And I've gotten those things that I think for my peace of mind and to feel, you know, a part of something in life is a special thing. And I'm a real loner kind of person, and my wife kind of is too. And we live in a very private little world kind of our own. And I just am unlikely to go out and socialize much ever unless I'm kind of forced to. So it's nice to just feel like I know people who are always there for me, and it goes back really a long way. You know, and to get to meet my nieces and really know them as adults. My brother has three girls. My sister has a girl and a boy. So my nieces and my nephews. And they're having kids, and just trying to be a little around a part of that. I really always had a very hard time navigating sort of family due to my own mental problems, kind of.
Yeah.
And it's part of solving all that I'm back here, kind of, I think.
That's very cool. you know, I kind of wondered about that just because, like, you know, obviously the changing seasons, you know, bring with them changing emotions. And I don't know, I mean, you know, living here in Cleveland and having friends that, like, say, live in California, it seems like the experience weather-wise in California would be pretty flat by comparison compared to what you see in Omaha and Cleveland as far as, like, the way things change.
The weather is beautiful in California. I love California. Yeah. I really, really do. We didn't leave there because we didn't like it. We just were going to have a change. We wanted to sell our house and kind of cash in our nest egg. And we just, you know, didn't know where to go. We were going to go somewhere in the, really in the middle of nowhere. And we're like, it'll be even harder then for me to get around and do my things. And we really just kind of found this house here that we thought looked really cool. And we just kind of made that change. But yes, what I was going to get to is, there was a slight thing when it was like relentlessly hot and sunny where you kind of feel like, you know, it becomes kind of like it's a grind on you, sort of like, I wish it would just cool off or something, you know. And especially if you're a loner at home and it's just crazy hot, you know, at certain times. And it gets that way here, but the AC just works differently here. I don't know, the way the seasons work and everything, you know. We couldn't get our AC to work. It would get so hot on our ranch house in Los Angeles, you know.
Oh, for sure.
So it's nice to, and we kind of don't even have to run it that much here, so it's just been a change. You know, we had a one-story, really classic 50s ranch house, which was awesome, but, like, now we live in this three-story house that's kind of this weird Disney-looking, like a French chateau style in the front, but it's sort of like this craftsman kind of honeycomb three-level place, and the basement level is ground level in the back of the house. So my studio is in the basement, but it really kind of just slightly in the ground. So it works really perfect for it.
That's awesome.
I call it the sub. It's kind of like a submarine down here because it has this kind of wood stuff, like sort of log cabin thing, but then I've brought all this kind of tiki oceanic stuff in. It's this weird combination, and everybody will get to see it who's on the Kickstarter, because I'll eventually I'm going to be posting footage and photos and everything.
That's very cool. Yeah, you know, that was something you mentioned, kind of like sorting out your own problems, and I was reading an interview with you that you did talking about the Altered Beast record, and, you know, about the realization, you know, later that you find out that you're, you know, bipolar, and that you had, you know, that around your family. And, you know, that was interesting to me because, I mean, I've got that around my family as well. And I wondered, you know, certainly under the best of circumstances, and I think you kind of detailed this a little bit, it was challenging for you to be a touring musician. And that, from what I read into it, that was, you know, challenging for you before you even knew what was going on. So I wondered, like, you know, once you kind of realize what the deal is, Was it challenging for you to kind of, like, start talking about that?
You know, it wasn't as hard for me to talk about it as it was to get to a point where I got treated, actually, for it.
Yeah.
I just did, you know, a long time of therapy and exhausted just every angle of things, and yet I was still getting to a point of panic and crisis where I just didn't know what to do, you know, and it just in cycles, you know, it's what being bipolar is. And I was having little, you know, it started in just after Altered Beast when I was having these little kind of nervous breakdowns and finding myself unable to get on planes to fly. And that was probably when people started saying, you know, if you got treated. And I did go to, you know, psychologists all through the 90s and into the early 2000s, and then I even went through a fear of flying course. You know, I went for six, seven years without flying at all. So yes, it was very difficult to be a touring musician and do it for me.
Yeah.
But I was losing so bad, that's how I functioned and made records and still toured and stuff, because I wasn't having to fly. But then I went through a thing with a pilot. It was very in-depth and kind of involved some hypnotism and stuff, as well as very lot of information about the technical aspects of flying, the physics of flying. This was a guy who flew big jets for 35 years, you know, all around the world for the big airlines. And in my talks with him, he said, you know, the way you're describing your problems, I think it goes beyond a fear of flying, and you need to go beyond psychologists and see a psychiatrist and really get to the bottom of it, because it's worse than even fear of flying, what you go through. And so, even so, I did start flying after that course. I flew with Brian Wilson to do a Letterman for this Radio City tribute concert for him. That was the first time I flew in many, many years. And then I went to Japan that summer. And then I toured all over Europe and Australia with the Thorns in 2002 or so. And all during that, I was sort of able to fly, but still really suffering bipolar pretty bad. When I got back off that tour is when I finally got treated with medication. And that was just completely life-changing for me. It makes it me able to enjoy playing live much more. It makes me able to enjoy life much more. You know, it's something that's hard to explain to a person who suffers a lot. I think when you're suffering, you feel like your world is so precarious. Any idea of anything changing it, you just want to avoid. It's already bad enough, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you just don't understand that it's not a medication that gives you a feeling. It's a medication that makes you feel normal. And that's just a really different thing, you know? You just don't feel super weird and panicked, you know what I mean? You just feel like, wow, this is how people go out and socialize and stuff, you know? Now I understand, because they feel normal and I really didn't, you know? And I still have to battle it, and honestly, as I get a little older, I feel like it's even more of a challenge for me to just keep from having, oh, they call them leaks, I guess, where I go off the rails for a day or two, you know?
Yeah.
It happens maybe a little more frequently, but I also am really aware of it. You know, I'm able to kind of pull out of it pretty quickly, so, you know, it's an ongoing struggle, and I wouldn't talk about it so much, but I think it's nice to do for other people that suffer. And also, it just helps explain a lot about me, I think, as an artist, if you know, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I think so, you know, and it's, I mean, again, having it in my family, it's really interesting, because I don't think until, you know, you experience it or it's around you, you really understand the struggle. Because, I mean, I know that, like, you know, medications, like, you know, it's always, there's always struggles with, like, keeping the levels right and all that kind of stuff. And when you talk about going off the rails for a day or so, you know, yeah, you know, things can be regulated and there can be something that can trigger it. So it's a really interesting, frustrating thing. There's a lot of layers.
Yeah, it's a difficult subject, too, because of just stigmas about it. Like,
yeah.
On the one hand, and it's probably true, on the one hand, there's the stigma that, oh, yeah, everybody gets handed up antidepressants and it's totally abused and they don't need them, right?
Yep.
And then on the other hand, there's the thing where by where I am. So like in Los Angeles, there's never any weirdness about being on meds. I feel like in Nebraska, people don't understand as well how much it helps a person who's suffering, you know, to get medicated. It's not just something you do for the hell of it. You
mm-hmm.
do it because there's no other choice, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I hate seeing it get negated by that blanket statement where it's like, you know, everybody's over-medicated, you know, because it really, it's a really big difference when you just can't fathom life and when you get a leg up on it and can function. It's a big difference, you know. But it's difficult growing up with it. Also, you know, in my family, I was the one that really was polarized from the other person in my family that suffered as even worse than me, which was my mother. And she never got treated or went to any psychology or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a very charged relationship that was really complex. And it was hard for me to separate myself from her as an adult because we were so kind of intertwined in a weird way.
Yeah.
A pressure I felt, you know, and it made me pull away, and just the weirdness of, you know, where, what's it like when she loves me, you know, because she was always very distracted and kind of unable to be there, you know, for us as kids as much as a person not suffering would have been, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, bless her heart now, I have no anger about it or anything like that, but, you know, I think it's a good world in which we face when there's something happening, but I think it's real easy in families for everyone to adjust around the troubled person rather than confront them and help get them to get help, you know what I mean?
Oh, for sure.
And as we know, people go to incredible lengths to get around what's uncomfortable in life, you know?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
I mean, Freud, I believe it was Freud, or could have been someone else, you know, neuroses is the avoidance of true suffering. Meaning, you know, you can really be in a bad place spending your whole life avoiding trying to feel bad.
Yeah. Well, musically, this run of shows that you're doing, was it just kind of a chance to get out and play some shows, or was there kind of a different purpose for you in going out and playing these shows while you're working on a record?
Really a chance to play some shows. We got offered a couple things that are sort of, you know, outdoor summer things, and it's the first time since I've lived here that we are taking advantage of doing a tour just in the Midwest, kind of around where I live.
Cool.
Which is really neat. You know, we kind of almost never would have done that without also going to the Northeast and the East Coast.
I tell you.
And being able to do shorter tours like this is really cool.
And you know what? We here in the Midwest, we usually miss out on some of those things that only go to the Northeast and otherwise. So I'm happy to hear that. So that's good.
Let me tell you, it's even worse for down south, because, you know, it's so expensive now for everybody to get to places like Dallas and Austin and some of these places we used to just play all the time.
Yeah.
The drives are just so long, and we're not using buses, you know, because it's just so crazy expensive to do.
Yep.
It's just kind of regulated things. And anytime we're not doing more Midwest dates, that's the only reason. Is we need to have enough big dates that pay well to sort of string together all the other stuff, and sometimes the distance makes that hard.
That makes sense. Well, just wrapping up, I wondered, the songs you're working on now, what can you tell us about the songs that you've written so far for this record? Are there some songs you can talk about specifically?
Well, I'd rather not really get into super specific. I'll say that to me, it feels very grounded. I have, kind of when I listen to them, I want to have a very satisfied feeling, and I'm getting that. And there's things popping out more like sporadically in lyrics or things, you know, that I feel like I can say because I'm back in the center of Nebraska, you know, of the country, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I feel, you know, I know, like, there's one of them where I go, you know, I'm out here in the middle of nowhere or something, you know, and it has a different kind of meaning because of where I am, you know. It has a slightly extra aspect to it because I'm here. I have one song that's actually called Off the Farm that is sort of about leaving and coming back in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of both things being bad or something. You know, it's a fantasy. You know what I mean? My songs aren't usually just exactly from my life.
Yeah.
But the stuff is all getting in there. You know what I mean? And I'm just enjoying, you know, the tracks were really fun to do. The drums sound really good, and they're good to play guitar on. It's just, I'm trying to, like, really enjoy myself, because that tends to really good results as well.
All right. Well, final bit, what else is on tap that you want folks to know about?
Geez, I don't know, other than the Kickstarter record I'm trying to get done by the fall. And other than that, go see the Big Eyes movie about Keen Art. I was a consultant on it.
Yeah.
with Amy Adams and Christoph Waltz, and that's been a big, big thing for us because we've been collectors for 20 years, and we got to go see them filming it and be really involved in providing artwork for it and helping them sort through the massive amount of stuff they reproduced for it with, you know, historical context and stuff. So that's been this amazing thing that happened, but I don't know really, you know, I don't benefit in any way tangibly other than it's been a fun hobby of ours, and it's just, like, you know, surreal to us that the movie got made with Tim directing it and Amy Adams, who we always dreamed would be the best Margaret. It was just kind of like, just like it wasn't happening. And there's another strange thing about it, which was that the minute we knew that movie was being made, it was like I looked at Lisa and I'm like, our work is done here. It was like, we really could leave Hollywood because this labor of love that we wanted their story to be a movie also had finally happened, you know?
That's very cool. How did they find out you were fans?
Well, I knew the writers, you know, when Girlfriend became successful, I talked about that I liked the movie Ed Wood, the Tim Burton movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine in Los Angeles, when I moved there, introduced me to Larry Karaszewski, who wrote the script with his partner, Scott. And Larry and I became pretty good friends over the years, and I was trying to kind of say, this would be a great movie, this would be a great movie, for a long time. But they kind of didn't get interested in it. And then I even met Tim Burton, who came to our house with his then-girlfriend, Lisa Marie, around 2000. And he pitched all my memorabilia to him, and he already knew Margaret and had commissions done. But I had all this info on the true story, you know? And he even was like, wow, have you talked to Larry about it? And I was like, yeah, he wasn't really interested. But lo and behold, in 2004, they decided they wanted to write a movie about them. And pretty quickly, they had together a production company and an actress and things. But it kept kind of falling through before going into production. And it went through two rounds of actresses and producers. And then it clicked together with Tim Burton, you know, at this last minute, and it went very quickly into production. Within 6 weeks, they were filming. So all of us just worked really hard. And, you know, I was the house where people would go each time there was a production company and an actress. They would come to our house, and we'd show them the paintings, and they'd be like, oh, my God, it's amazing, you know. And Rick, the production designer from the movie Big Eyes, came over, and we really spent time with him. And, you know, we provided the stuff by the other artists that kind of showed the explosion of it, you know, and because we collected a lot of them as well. And a lot of our actual prints and things were used for, like, their window scenes and stuff. So that's my blab on teens.
There you go, man. That is so cool. I'll let you run.
I think it's important, iconic art.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, thank you for the time, man. I'll let you run to your next one, but we're looking forward to seeing you back in Cleveland, as always.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I'm excited to go there. You know, it's been long enough that I could get in the very long line for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Well, we'll have to see if we can get you in there. I approve.
I don't know how you do it, but you're local, so. But I know you have to be 20 years since your first record, but I'm past that. Because my first record was 86. For a major.
We will start stumping right now. So
it's not really something I care about, but when I think Cleveland, I have to bring it up.
Awesome. Well, thank you, man. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.